make sure it's also the smallest audience, but I think the highly interested audience. You've paid for the tutorial, so you should make the best out of it. I'm sure you will bomb him with questions. You will concurrently interact during the presentation. So to get the best feedback about a very exciting area, critical system development with UML. At the beginning, I thought this tutorial is a contradiction in itself. If you design a critical system, you need solid foundations. And UML has no solid foundations. So I'm really looking forward how this contradiction will be solved in the tutorial. I also tried to attend it, but I've still scheduled quite a lot of organizational affairs, so I will eventually show up. I would like to introduce to you the lecturer. It's Jan Jürgens. He's a researcher at the Technical University of Munich in Germany. And may I make some advertisement? He's author of a forthcoming book with Springer Verlag, Plan for 204, Secure Systems Development with UML. So you are the first test person that will get to know the forthcoming Springer book.
So we have a free copy here?
We would be glad to give you free copies, because the book first needs to be written before you can distribute it completely. He authored around 30 papers, gave several invited talks, and he presented 20 tutorials on international conferences. So the working area is in computer security in connection with software engineering, and he's initiator and current chair of the working group on formal methods in software engineering for safety and security within the German Society of Computer Science. He's the member of the executive board of the Division of Safety and Security, the member of the advisory board of the Bavarian Competence Center for Safety and Security, and so on, and so on. Usually, if I present a speaker, I'm used to quite long lists of positions and affiliations and jobs he got, but I think it's very unusual that such a young speaker has such a long list. Okay? I hope you meet the tutorial with great expectations, and I hope you will fulfill these expectations. The large audience is all yours.
Okay, thank you very much for your lecture. Thank you very much for the opportunity to give this tutorial. Yes, and this was actually a right remark. I mean, it's, as I will point out in a couple of slides, that it is in fact an interesting challenge to try to use UML for critical systems development. So I will say about the remarks that Professor Dosh said in the beginning that it's in effect true. So I will say a bit about that, how to resolve these problems. That's one, actually one part of the content of this tutorial. And there was another question already about the book. So it's not printed yet, but I have a version which is hopefully very close to the final version. And so if you're interested, then I can send you that. So it's actually on a website, which I will give at the end. Or actually, it's probably one of the last slides in your handout already. You need a password, but I think it should be there. Also the third to last, and the last one. Not the last one. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so, okay. As the title says already, it's the tutorial is about developing critical systems with UML, where critical, in the largest meaning, would mean systems that are supposed to satisfy some kind of non-functional requirement. And in this presentation, I would plan on focusing specifically on safety and security critical systems. And I wanted to start the tutorial because there's some scope in concentrating on different subtopics more or less. So I wanted to start by asking you about your background and your specific interests. So let's start with who of you is from university? Maybe raise a hand. and anyone from industrial research labs, government agencies, or okay, so we are all universities here, pretty much, okay. And so who of you is more interested in safety? Okay, and security? Also, so okay, some mixture. So I will sort of, talk about both topics. Okay, the last thing I want to ask is your knowledge about UML, because I can sort of see how much of an introduction I will give in the beginning of the tutorial. So who of you knows a little bit about UML already? I suppose everyone has sort of heard of the UML, but but I should give some introduction still probably. Mm-hmm. Okay. Or is there any expert here in UML? Okay. Good. So I will give some background on that. Okay. Yeah. So much about my questions. Oh, and before I forget, I can actually continue with questions from my side. I always think about this questionnaire. So I can improve on this tutorial, and you can use it and invited to whenever you think of something during the tutorial, just write down some remarks on what you like about the tutorial or what you don't like too much, and yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Would be nice if you could just leave them here in the end or give them to me then at the end of the tutorial. We will have until 5 o'clock, I think, and there will be a break at, I think, 3:30, or was it 3 o'clock? Does anyone know, actually? 3 o'clock, okay, so I should try to remember that. Mm-hmm. Okay, so yeah, that's so much for the organization. Then I will just start with the tutorial. Oh yeah, and if you have any questions, then you can, of course, ask them immediately. So for me it's also nice to have as much interaction as possible, so I don't just keep on talking myself, so you are always invited to ask any kind of question, so don't think that the question would be too stupid or anything. That's, you know, it's usually not the case. And anyway, I'm happy about giving more detail about whatever topics, so you just have to give me a hint what you're interested in. Okay, so firstly, to start with some motivation about this work. In general, so the starting point of this work is the realization that it's actually quite difficult to develop critical systems where, again, critical may mean dependable or safety critical or security critical or real time and so on, to develop these kind of systems to a high level of quality, in the sense that the system should actually fulfill its intended goals. And it's apparent that this must be difficult, because there are many examples of systems in practice which actually fail to live up to their intended goals with respect to criticality requirements. I think there are many well-known examples for that in the various domains. So in safety critical systems, for example, there one of the big examples was in the late 90s, the crash of the Ariane rocket, which was related to software problems. So it was the case that people had reused old software from an older version of the rocket with a new version, and then it did not work anymore as expected. So in that sense, it's a software bug, although it's not just a matter of mistyping something, but it's a certain kind of bug, of course. But one example for a software bug in safety critical systems, which really had rather disastrous result, I think, a couple of 100 million were lost there in terms of the satellite which was supposed to put into space, which instead blew up. And of course, in security, there are maybe even more examples, like almost every day in the media you have some example about websites being hacked or well, of course viruses being spread around and well, to some degree today I think almost everyone who uses the internet at all is well, is personally well, affected by the problems there. So yeah, this shows that this is really a problem, so that it's really difficult to develop critical systems correctly in the sense that they actually fulfill the criticality requirements that they're supposed to fulfill. And of course you may then ask yourself why this is the case. Of course, I mean, problems have been around for quite a long time, not only just the last couple of years. And the it could be that the slides are changed a bit since I submitted the version for printout, but I think essentially they should be the same anyway. Anyway, so yeah, and the question is why is it so much of a problem? And I think one part of this explanation is actually that, well, of course, in practice, you always have to worry about costs of developing software. And if you had an unbounded amount of costs or of money and also of time, then you could probably construct a system to a high degree of quality, whichever level you would like to have. But that's not the reality. So you have to worry about time to market, because you want to bring out your product before the competing companies. And then also, of course, you have to worry about costs, because in the end you want to make profit. And yeah, that's why you have to worry about cost. And so, yeah, I think that is one of the reasons why such problems happen in practice. And the thing is that, of course, people at universities or in research have realized the problem for quite a long time now, and there have been, of course, there has been also been a lot of research on trying to address the problem, and specifically under the label of formal methods. And there has been quite successful research actually, but the problem is that it has not been used so much in industrial, real industrial development, except for specific situations where you're really forced maybe by law or by regulations to use such a development method. But otherwise it's unfortunately it's not so much used, and reason, as I said already, is at least the perceived cost of using formal methods in systems development, because because firstly you have to train your people. Many software developers don't have a background in formal methods. That's one point that may cost money, or you have to hire people with this specific training who may be more expensive. And then secondly, in each situation where you want to, for example, verify a formal specification, firstly, of course, you have to construct the formal specification, because it doesn't usually exist already. So that these are two reasons why formal methods are perceived as expensive in industry and why they're not so much in use. And so now the approach taken in this tutorial in a way builds on this old approach of formal methods, and the slogan of model-based development can still be seen in that setting. So firstly, this just means that instead of writing your code right away, you firstly, of course, you have to think about your requirements that you always have to do. But secondly, what you do before you write your code, you construct models of some sort. And of course, in some sense, this is also what formal methods is about. That's I think that you could still see as a specific instance of this overall approach, and this is also the approach taken in this tutorial. But now, of course, the question then is how the models would look like, and well, I see this overall approach of model-based development in the context of a larger tendency in computer science to enable people to program computers in a way that is closer to their own intuitive ideas, as opposed to being close to the code which is actually executed in the end on the computer. So if historically, and at the beginning of writing software for computers, we actually had to write the software in the machine code, and then while people defined higher level languages such as BASIC, Pascal, and so on, and now this could be seen as another step in this development, and specifically if you then use UML as an example for this this model-based development approach, where here you then take UML models, the motivation is then that the UML notation is supposed to be rather intuitive. So it's a visual notation consisting of diagrams, as I will explain in more detail in a couple of slides. And so you could see it as a natural extension of the overall development to always try to get closer to human ideas and enable humans to formulate their ideas in a way which is as intuitive as possible. But at the same time, as I said before, what one has to keep in mind is to, of course, one wants to increase the quality of the critical systems, but also you have to worry about time to market and costs, because otherwise it will not be used in industry. So, yeah, this model-based development you could, of course, use also for systems that are not critical in some sense, but more specifically, when you worry about critical requirements, again, in the sense of safety or security critical and so on, then the model-based approach has specific advantages for this application specifically, because it enables you to consider the critical properties from early on in the development process. The advantage of that is that it has been shown already a long time ago, for example, by Böhm, quite a long time ago, that it is much less expensive to correct mistakes in early phases of the system development, but preferably also already at the requirement elicitation phase, because then you only have to correct your informal model, as opposed to actually having to correct the implemented code, which is of course much more work. And so the advantage is to start early on with the critical with considering critical properties, and also within the actual development context. So by then, if you in this approach, you then use UML as a notation, and this is actually used already in industry, then you can consider your critical requirements within the actual development context, and this actually helps you to catch some bugs which otherwise you might never actually see. For example, this the bug which I mentioned in the setting of the Ariane rocket, there the problem was actually the mismatch between some version of the software and another version of the rocket which did not match. And so if you it would be good if you could consider your critical properties within an integrated setting where you can talk about properties of the rocket and talk about properties of the software in a seamless way, so you where you're able to put all of this information together and to make consistency checks whether it's actually the right software for the right system. And so the overall, yes? Mm-hmm.
What do you mean the critical interpretation by text generation?
Ah, okay. So,
the last
one. Yes. Yeah, so the first point, yes, this I just wanted to explain just now. So the overall process is then divided in two steps. I mean, firstly, you construct models, and then you analyze the models for the critical requirements. But of course, what you want to execute are not models, but code. So yeah, then you have to get from models to code. And while there are actually two different ways, which I will also mention on the next slide, you could either generate the code automatically from the models, or you could also still write the code manually, and then coming back to the question, you can verify that the implementation actually satisfies or conforms to the model by generating test sequences from the model, and thereby making sure that the model actually does what the system says. And yeah, this is actually what I'm saying on this slide. So in the setting of model-based development, I had this diagram earlier, and now to explain how to get from the upper levels to the lower ones, firstly, the requirements. You can verify models with respect to the requirements if your models are precise enough, so you can use some sort of verification. And then, as I said, the second step would be to somehow derive code from the models.
What exactly is the difference? Maybe it's too complex. What exactly is the difference between requirements and models?
Requirements is here meant in a more informal way. Firstly, informally, and then secondly, you can also make the requirements formal. What I mean here is the distinction between models and requirements would be, for example, by model here I mean something like an executable, or maybe not executable, but at least a model of the intended functionality of the system, whereas requirement could also be a non-functional requirement, so which is not something talking about the functional aspect of the system, but a non-functional one. So in principle, models you might be able to execute, although of course in general, some people say that specifications should not be executable, but I mean, apart from this discussion, in the UML sense, you can actually, at least in principle, you can execute the models, such as state charts, you know, state machines, whereas with requirements, what I mean here are, for example, logical conditions on the models, that the models are supposed to be to fulfill, such as pre-post conditions or hard prequels or things like that. So, but I mean, the distinction is probably there's some sort of gray area because you can get from one to the other. This is not meant to be a precise definition to separate this, mm-hmm. but just to show that, well, at least in practice, you start out with informal requirements anyway, and then mm-hmm. you somehow get to the models, which may be more formal. Then what's the question?
I have two questions. First one may be already answered. The verification is only possible between two formal models.
Mm-hmm.
So says that your requirements are the formal model of the system.
The requirements are not formal model, not a formal complete model of the system, but formalized conditions on various aspects of the system.
So the validation.
You would probably say so. If the requirements are formalized, then you can actually formally verify the models if they are also formal. But if they are not, if they are informal, then you would probably rather say that you do a validation here. Yes. Yeah. So these are two different things which you can do when you go from requirements to models.
Second question, how do you specify the non-functional properties? I'm really interested in the example. I'm glad you can talk about it in the next slide.
Yes, I will actually talk about it in more detail about that in the remaining part of the call. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes. Which so yeah, I mean what I said so far, you could do with any kind of notation for specifying your models. But now, as I said in this work, I'm using the unified modeling language. UML, which I will introduce in more detail later, and here I would just mention, well, okay, UML is the de facto, the current de facto standard in industrial modeling, in object-oriented systems anyway, and increasingly also in systems which are not necessarily object-oriented, and this is, this is the main motivation for trying to use UML in this context. And then the second point, well, this is a sort of debatable point, you could say, I mean, it depends on your point of view, as Professor Doss already mentioned in the introduction. So UML is relatively precisely defined if you consider that so many people know and use UML. And so if you compare it to other design notations in the object-oriented field which existed before UML, and in fact UML was created by unifying a couple of these notations, as the name says already. So from that point of view it is relatively precisely defined, but as I will point out in more detail later, it's only relative, and that was mentioned earlier. So for example, the semantics of the UML models in terms of the execution semantics in the official definition document is only defined in English words as opposed to mathematical formulas. But yeah, this is still better than what had existed in this field before UML. So that's why relatively precisely defined. Another advantage is there are many tools which exist already for to be used in the context of using UML for system development. And initially, this started out with tools which allow you just to draw the UML models, but increasingly you also get the tools for simulation or some sort of code generation to some degree at this point, and so on. And there's many more tools are developed there also in many universities. Yes.
What is the current state in this respect to code generation?
The current state is that many commercial tools can generate very basic code in the sense of class definitions or things like that, and in terms of behaviorally relevant code, for example, you know, translating state charts into whatever Java code or so, there's a lot of work going on, but I don't think that there's a real product there yet. I mean, there are some tools, for example, Poseidon tool, which is a tool actually which is marketed quite close to here, namely in Hamburg by Gentleware, and this. For example, does some sort of code generation. I think there's a better version of a plugin which can generate Java code from state charts. I think that's the current version, the current state. Mm-hmm. Yes. But now to the challenges in trying to use UML in this the context of critical systems development using models. So firstly, what would be helpful anyway is if you could try to adapt UML to the specific application domains such as safety or security critical systems. Then you have to worry about how to use the UML correctly in the application domain. If you worry about practical application of the notation, then usage is always important, how to use it correctly. And while something which I mentioned already, that there's, well, UML, the semantics of UML diagrams is not completely unambiguous. There are some points where you could, you know, where people actually debate on what is now precisely meant. And the point is that within the UML community, there are actually people on the practical side of the community who say that this is actually a good thing rather than a bad thing. Of course, the people on the theoretical side say it's a bad thing. So even within the UML community, there's some debate on whether you want flexibility, which would be offered by some sense of not being very clear about something. I mean, this gives you flexibility to some degree, although you may not, one may not like this sense of flexibility. And there are some cynical remarks about that. Without ambiguity, there is no consensus. So people say, I mean, in practical software development, it is actually often quite helpful if in the beginning it is not completely clear what exactly or how exactly the system should be constructed, because then people have more freedom to interpret the UML models. I mean, there you, if you think about these things, you get, quickly get into psychology of, you know, of actually writing software in practice, and that's where in this kind of work where I would actually stop. I mean, this is not really what I can say about much, but here I'm more concentrating on the technical aspects, and here for that reason I also need some degree of unambiguity, and because it does not exist officially, I have to define my own formal semantics for a fragment of UML to use in this context, but I will say more about that later. And yeah, lastly, the approach which I'm presenting in this tutorial, for that it is important to have advanced tool support, and in this setting, not only tool support for drawing diagrams, which you can do already, but also for analyzing the diagrams for the critical requirements. And the idea is that what I defined UML extension for safety and for security critical systems, which allows you to include your critical requirements within the UML model, but then it's of course necessary that you can then automatically verify whether the UML model actually satisfies these requirements. So one part of the work which we're working on at the moment is to develop tool support which can actually do that. Yeah, so this is what I say in more detail on this slide. So the I defined two extensions which I will present in this tutorial, one for safety critical and one for security critical systems, extensions of UML, which firstly allow you to include the requirements in the UML model, and then secondly to evaluate the UML models for weaknesses in the design with respect to these requirements. And so this is the sort of analysis part of the approach. Then you also have a synthesis part. You can also use this extension to offer established solutions in a specific application domain to people who may not have a strong background in that application domain. So for example, in security, you can offer them certain labels which they can put on their UML diagrams, and in the context of the tool support, this then means that the UML diagram now includes a new level, for example, that the diagram before you, for example, you generate code or you make analysis, you should include, for example, a security protocol at a certain part of the specification where you have included this label which has this interpretation of that one should include a security protocol. So this is the sort of more synthetic part of the approach. And as I said, the goal is to enable people to develop critical systems who may not have such a strong background in the And then as I said already, the advantage of this is that you can consider the critical requirements from early phases of the system development and within the system context. And what is a side effect, sometimes in practice you are also interested in certifying your software to some kind of regulation, and there you often need documentation. And so if you use this model-based approach, you already have your documentation in form of the UML diagrams, and that way, if you want to have that, then this is actually not more effort which you have to spend because you have the diagrams already. So now on a technical level, the idea of this approach using UML is that you have these critical requirements which you want your system to fulfill, and the observation is that many of the important requirements come up a lot. So and they can actually be made precise in a rather universal way. So this means that if you want to formalize these requirements in order to be able to apply automatic analysis of the models against the requirements, you don't have to do this again with every new system, but you can do it for many of these requirements, you can do it universally once and for all. So this is what I've been doing in this work, to take some of the important requirements and formalize them in a universal way, and then offer the users of this approach the possibility to include the requirements as labels in UML diagrams, so-called stereotypes, and thereby these formalized requirements can then be verified against the formal execution model of the used fragment of UML. So firstly, this remark applies to the requirements, such as, well, non-functional requirements, such as a system should, a value should be given back within a certain time bound, for example. Then secondly, this remark also applies to your environment models. So in critical systems, it's usually the case that you have to make sure that your system behaves as expected in the context of some environment which may be malicious in some way. If the environment would not be malicious, then there's usually not much of a problem and you don't have to worry about it too much. But in many cases, for example, in safety critical systems, you worry about possible failures, for example, of underlying hardware components. And in security critical systems, you worry about adversaries that may willfully try to attack your system. Again, here the point is that you can formalize the models for both failures and adversaries in a universal way. So you don't have to do it again for each new system you want to construct, but you can do it once and for all, and include it in this UML approach for critical systems development. As I said, you can do this by attaching the models in a way on the syntax level using stereotypes. And this allows you to evaluate these specifications against these environment models and to establish whether the included requirements are actually fulfilled against the environment models. So just to give a bit of an overview what this tutorial is supposed to be about. Firstly, I will give a bit of background on UML. Then I will present two of these extensions of UML, firstly for safety critical and then for security critical systems. Then I will say a bit about what it means to use UMA in a formal design process. So I will come back to the points mentioned earlier about problems with UMA in that, that context. Then I will say a bit about model-based testing, which I also already mentioned, and about tool support, and say a bit about some case studies if I have time. And yeah, I will here concentrate on safety and security, but you can generalize the overall approach to other application domains also. Yeah, so firstly some background on UMA. So yeah, as I said already, it's a visual notation. Firstly for object-oriented systems, but you can also use it for component-oriented systems simply by not making use of these specific object-oriented features such as inheritance, aggregation, and so on, but just viewing what you would normally view as objects. Of course, you can also view as components, and then you can use UMA also to specify component-oriented systems which may not be object-oriented. And UMA offers you different views on the system, which include things like the physical level of the system, or the architecture of the system, or behavioral specifications for different components in the system, and so on. And it allows you to take different levels of abstractions, which is also good if you want to do verification. And as I said already, it's the de facto industry standard in this field, and something which is really useful. There are standard extension mechanisms which you can use to extend, to officially extend the UMA notation to a specific application domain. So what is UMA? Yeah? Mm-hmm.
When you say different views on the system, different interpretation?
In the setting of UMA, this means you have different kinds of diagrams which describe different aspects of the system. So for example, the physical architecture, where you have things like servers and communication links between the servers, that's one view, so it's the physical view in a way. Or you may have the behavioral view, which allows you to specify the actual behavior as it's supposed to be executed later. But we will see that on the next couple of slides. And so this is what UMA looks like. If you look at it from far away, as I said, a different couple, different kinds of diagrams. And I will say a bit about these diagrams in the next couple of slides. So but firstly, I will mention that here I am not using all of UMA, but only a fragment. And one reason for that is that the UMA is quite a big notation, firstly in terms of kinds of diagrams, and part of the reason for that is historically, because it was defined from different notations which existed before UMA. So what happened exactly was that in, I think in 96, three of the of proponents of three different object-oriented design methods got together in one company, Rational, and decided that since they now work together, they may as well merge their different development methods, and this resulted in the UMA. And in particular, this means that there are quite a few kinds of diagrams, because the different kinds of diagrams existing before were partially just put together in some sense. So here we're just using some of the diagrams, or the kind of diagrams offered by the UMA. And secondly, also, if you look at each diagram, a diagram itself can in UMA can also be quite complicated. So there are different different parts of the diagram which you can use, and different notation elements, and all of these notation elements have their uses in specific situations, but most of them you don't use a lot, or you don't need a lot. And actually I think that for the main usage it suffices to just take a relatively simple fragment of the UML notation. And this is also what I'm doing here, not only to keep the presentation short enough, but also because, as I said already, I want to use this together with tool support, and I don't think it's feasible to construct advanced tool support which allows you, for example, analysis of behavioral aspects of a UML model. I don't think this is possible if you allow the developer to actually use all of UML as it is defined officially in the definition document, which I think has about 600 pages or something. So, and it's just a huge, very huge document, and I think it should be clear that you cannot formalize all of that. And that's why, firstly, I only take some of the diagrams, and in each case, I only consider a simplified or restricted version of the diagram, which is sufficient for my use here.
I have a very individual question. I used UML a couple of years ago, and I had the impression that the subsystem is a collection of classes, mm-hmm. and the package is a collection of modules, and the subsystem is related to the structural view, and the subsystem is related to the physical view.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there may be different usages of UML in specific, or taught by specific books, but the official version is that you have, I will explain what packages are on a later slide. Okay. Maybe I should wait, because otherwise the other people will not know what I
was doing.
I will explain all of the diagrams on the next couple of slides, and so when we come to packages, I will say a bit about the difference. Well, we have some example there. So, these are the different kinds of diagrams which I actually use here. And while it's already listed there, you could already read that each of them has different usage, and each you can use to describe a different view on the system. And there are some more diagrams, for example, use case diagram, which I use to some degree also in the context of this approach, but it's not so central here because I concentrate more on verifying non-functional requirements, and use case diagrams are usually used in a rather informal way in early stages of the system development, so they don't play such a big role here. And then you also have collaboration diagrams, which contain pretty much the same information as sequence diagrams. And you also have component diagrams, which give part of the information of deployment diagrams, which is included here. I use most of the diagrams, but in each case in a simplified version. So now to say a bit about each of the kinds of diagrams. Firstly, class diagrams allow you to specify the data structure of the system, or the class structure if it's really an object-oriented system. Classes are represented by rectangles, which include a class name, possibly attributes and operations, with arguments, and in each case also types and return types possibly. And you can also include tags and stereotypes, which we'll explain later what that is. And then between the different classes, you may have relationships. These may be associations, aggregations, and so on. What I'm using here in this context especially is that you can also specify things such as call dependencies, saying that this class, class 2, should be able to call a method at the class, class 1. So that's so much about class diagrams. Then for each of the objects or components, you can use state charts to specify the behavior of this component or object. And stage charts are really, well, go back on the old idea of stage machines, which were transformed into a visual notation, firstly by David Harrell, also called stage charts, and these were included in UML as well. Although here they have a slightly different semantics as in the original stage chart definition. But yeah, still you have different states and you have transitions between states, which can be triggered by events such as messages arriving from the environment of the object. Then for each transition you may specify a condition which has to be fulfilled for the transition to fire whenever this this event happens. And lastly, you can also specify an action which should be executed whenever the transition is fired. Yeah, so much about state charts. Then, similar to state charts, one has activity diagrams. The difference to state charts is mainly that here you can specify the joint or the coordinated behavior of different kinds of components or objects by using so-called swim lanes, which allow you to divide the overall diagram into parts belonging to each of the objects or components. And then also the what I didn't mention right now, with the states, you also have the possibility to use hierarchy. So each state may have a substate and so on. And similar thing you can do in activity diagrams, only there the substates are each written as individual states and by using so-called synchronization bars. So in state charts, this whole thing would be written as one state, which with the substates which are written here, instead of using the synchronization bar. But otherwise, the diagrams are really very similar. And yeah, and you also have the same kind of actions, conditions, and so on in activity diagrams. And then sequence diagrams. These you can use to specify the interaction between different kinds of objects or components by exchanging messages. And you do this by writing the object names at the top of the diagram and under that so-called lifeline, and then messages from one object to another object are written as an arrow between the lifelines with the methods put as a label at the arrow. And you can also specify guards which have to be fulfilled so that the execution of the diagram continues at this point. This is a bit specific syntax which I will explain in more detail. This is just an example which I just took from the later examples in the security critical part. And while it looks very complicated, the point is that in security, you often use things like cryptographic operations to encrypt messages, and these you can specify that way. But for now, we can ignore this, so I will explain that when I use them, actually.
I also have a question. Mm-hmm. What's the relationship between this message interaction here and the relationship between class diagrams, the core relationship?
Yes, okay. And then the class diagram, you would specify the structure of the system. And in sequence diagrams, you can then...
I mean the class relationship, this core relationship.
Yes. So this is still a structure, structural information. This just means that the class 2 is allowed at some point to call class 1. It does not say when it is calling it or anything. It's just a sort of type information, as in typed programming languages. Just says what is allowed to happen at all, and then you can use a sequence diagram. You can use a sequence diagram to then actually specify the behavior, and the relationship is then that whenever you have, for example, a message from C to S, then in the corresponding class diagram, where here you would have a C and no, it's a thing. So if you interpret this message as a, or this arrow as a call operation, so the object C calls a message as the object S, then in the class diagram there should be an arrow from C to S. So here you should have the C and there you should have the S. And then the diagram just says that C is in fact allowed to call S. And if that would not be the case, then the two kinds of diagrams would be inconsistent. So the class diagram and the sequence diagram. That answers the question. Okay.
Can I specify that maybe class B can only call a method maybe init and class R?
Yeah, in the class yes. Diagram? You can use interfaces. I have them on this. Yeah, on this slide. This is actually now in the setting of packages, but you can also use them in the setting of class diagrams and interfaces. You can use for that purpose. In an interface means that if you have some other object and there's an arrow from the other object, not to the class model, to the other class model, but to the interface or to one interface which is associated with the class model, then this means that the first object is allowed only to call the methods which are mentioned in this interface. So you can use an interface to restrict the number of methods that can be called from the outside. I don't know if this is clear, if this answers the question. So in your example, if you had the message init, which should, the object from class 1 should be able only to call the message init from class 2 and not any other message, then you would write init in this definition part of the interface, and then you would have an arrow from class 1 to the interface of class 2 and not directly to class 2.
But there's no other possibility. So as if I don't want another interface and I just want these two classes, there's no special way to put the arrow from maybe the first class just to the method in it?
No, I don't think that's allowed. You do have to use an interface to do that. It's a bit more complicated maybe, but it may also make things more clearer, because if you write an arrow to one method, then you know there's a danger that you know it goes up or down on the line, and suddenly if you just write it down by hand, it's not clear which method it points to. So I think in many cases it's good to be a bit more explicit, and you know to which looks like a bit more work, but then you avoid some mistakes maybe. But yeah, okay. Talking about the problem diagrams. So these allow you to firstly specify nodes, which could be computer servers or actually physical entities in your system, and then also to specify logical components which reside on the nodes, so such as a program which is executed on a computer. And between the nodes you can specify communication links using just a line, and between the components you can again specify dependencies such as a call dependency. So in a way the component part of a deployment diagram corresponds to a class diagram, only here we're looking at components and not at classes. And in this way you can get a comparison or a match between the physical level and the logical level of the system and make sure that this is consistent. Lastly, the packages. A package is simply a box which you can draw around a couple of diagrams. And then the question earlier, in general, this box you may be divided into firstly a specification part and a realization part. I think this is what the question referred to. This means that in the one part you specify you give a specification of the intended part of the system, and in the other part you give a more concrete specification which is supposed to represent the actual implementation of the system. But here I'm just using the specification part, so I don't have this division here. And then subsystems are a specific kind of package, and the notation is just to include this symbol at the top of the diagram, and the meaning of that is really just that the subsystem is so firstly a package you can just use to group together different diagrams for some reason, you want to clean up your specification, and so you package some of the diagrams up. But with the subsystem, the intention is that these different diagrams which are included in the subsystem actually represent a part of the system which is then specified using the different kinds of diagrams which are included in the package. So in this example, the subsystem channel is supposed to specify a part of the system which actually supposed to represent a communication channel here between two nodes, and you have a connection between them. Then you have a very simple activity diagram and a very simple state chart and a very simple class diagram here just for illustration. So this is the way that specifically in this presentation I'm using subsystems to specify the different kinds of views on a given part of the system. So I don't know if this answers the question.
Okay.
And here you can also use the interfaces. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I have a question to the word component. Mm-hmm. Do you know what kind of definition is used in UML for the word component?
That's
is
a good question.
One from Perthi, or is it in
further? There are many different definitions for components, and I think so in UML, I think the official definition is that this is. Well, actually, I would have to look up the official wording. I mean, there is some official definition of that in the definition document, and the requirement is that it is an implementable part of the system, which somehow constitutes a part of the system which you can usefully package up from the rest of the system. So this is not the official wording. I can look it up in the break in the official definition document. The problem is that the official document the official definition is one thing, but the usage is another thing. And as I said, I don't think many people have actually read the official definition document. And so if you look at the UML books, then you can sometimes see that at least components, I mean, it's also in UML, it's everyone uses the word component for whatever he thinks it should mean, and it's a bit of a chaos there also, but there is an official definition somewhere, yeah. Then the last thing about the definition of UML, which particularly interesting here is the extension mechanisms. So firstly, we already saw stereotypes, and we had this example of the call stereotypes. So these are labels in double angle brackets, which you can attach to model elements to give them a specific meaning. So, for example, in this call dependency, we had this arrow which just denotes some kinds of some kind of dependency between different classes. And if we put the call label or the call stereotype on it, then this means specifically the dependency consists of one object should be able to call the other object. And then, secondly, you can not only attach labels to diagram elements, which of course is useful and looks nice maybe, but you could say, well, this is a bit only on the surface, and I would like to be able to also say something of the intended semantics of this, the specialization, and for that you can use firstly tagged values and secondly constraints, where tagged values are associated with stereotyped elements, and they can include additional information. So you have tag value pairs, where tag is some sort of attribute on the meta level, so an attribute of the diagram as opposed to an attribute of the object, and the value is then a value of this tag. And we will see examples for that later. So it's, for example, the stereotype should represent some kind of real-time requirement. Then you can use a tag to specify what the requirement is exactly. So you could here use whatever, just real-time as a stereotype, and then say specify the exact time bound using the tagged value. And thirdly, the constraint. So this is a logical, or can be a logical condition, which should be fulfilled so that the diagram correctly carries the stereotype. And this can then also refer to a semantics of the stereotyped element. And if you put all together all this information, then this is usually called a profile, and this is related to a specific application domain, such as safety or security critical systems. And it's also possible within the object management group who defined the UML to also have an official standardization of a given profile for a specific application domain. And this exists already in the case of real-time systems, so there's a real-time extension of UML.
A stereotype situated at the data level, right?
Yes.
You add new syntactic elements to UML.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then stereotypes on the meta level, and then the stereotyped model elements are on the actual model level. Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can say a bit more about these different levels and how UML is defined. Well, I was planning to do that in the section about tools. So, yeah, are there any questions at this point about what I said about UML so far? And I will, yeah.
So, what you are saying is UML in some notations, the notation of the meaning of notation may not be precisely defined.
Yeah, so it is precise on the level of natural language. So it's defined using English words in this official documentation document. And there are some points where you have so-called semantic variation points. And this, well, you could, cynically you could say, this is a nice word for saying, we don't know ourselves exactly what this is supposed to mean. But as I said already, there are some people who say that this is actually a very useful thing to have because this makes the thing more flexible. So you can just start by writing the diagram and you say, well, this could mean this or could mean that. I don't care at this point, and I will make this more specific later when I'm actually starting to implement the system or something. So this is the motivation why this is so. Although when I want to use when I want to analyze the UML models using tool support in a sort of formal way, then of course the tool has to know what I mean exactly, because it cannot just guess. So there are then two choices how you resolve the situation. Of course you can firstly sit down and implement all different variation points, so all different interpretations of the variation point, and then ask the user, if you analyze the document, ask him, what do you now mean exactly with this? This is the sort of complete solution for the problem, you know, this mismatch between informal and formal approach. But of course it's more work, because in each point you have to offer different kinds of meanings. And then, well, with the tools work, which we've been doing so far, we made a simplification by just choosing one of the possible interpretations, and the one that is sufficient for us in our situation. So that's how, for the time being, we solve this problem. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I will now say a bit, or start with the safety critical part of the tutorial. So here the intention is to use UML as a notation for model-based development of safety critical systems. And I will start by giving a bit of background about the aspects of safety that are relevant in, on the next couple of slides. And for that, firstly I should say that what I'm presenting here only concerns a specific aspect of safety, which I chose to keep the presentation short enough. And this is not, in a way, not the whole story. It's not all you can say about safety, but it's a specific aspect of it, namely mainly related to fault tolerance, as I will explain later. But the overall setting is safety critical systems. And then also, I will now restrict our attention simply to safety critical systems. So all systems we now consider are safety critical. And this means in particular such questions whether, you know, whether there's a distinction between reliability or dependability and safety. I don't consider the distinctions here, because I just consider on the focus on the safety critical systems, which may or may not have to satisfy reliability or dependability requirements. So I'm sort of concentrating on this, the intersection between the three kinds of sub-areas. So firstly some background on safety. An observation is that safety is often considered with respect to failure condition categories, meaning what kind of impact a certain failure may have on its environment, such as the humans that have to deal with the system. And there are different levels which you can define, from the worst case, catastrophic, biohazardous, major and minor, down to no effects. So this is just an observation for now, that while you have different levels of safety criticalness, and correspondingly in many different standards, such as this certain avionics standard, you actually have this different kinds of safety levels specified. And this is something which I mentioned here, because this will be used in the UML part in a couple of slides. And then another observation about safety critical systems is that safety goals are often specified via the maximum allowed failure rate, meaning in a given point or in a given period of time, how many failures may arise at the system. And there are actually safety critical systems such as airplanes, for example, where these requirements can be very stringent. So one typical number of one in these very statistical systems is the probability of 10 to the minus 9 that there is a system failure within 1 hour of execution of the system. And while this is a very small number, which of course doesn't tell you anything if you, you know, just look at it, and if you then try to compute what this means, how much time should pass before you actually get one failure, then of course you have to consider how many years are 10 to the minus 9 hours, and you get after some computation you get to realize that this would be about 100,000 years. So the requirement of 10 to the minus 9 failures in 1 hour corresponds to one failure in 100,000 years, and this is just, you know, I made this comparison to make clear that this you cannot establish just by testing, because, well, naively you would have to say that you would have to let the system run for 100,000 years to establish this, which is not very useful.
Why do you choose fader rate instead of header frame?
Yes, so there's a sort of step between from failures to hazards, and the point is that here I'm concentrating more on the technical side as opposed to the impact to humans. And so this is what I see, the sort of transition from failures to hazards, or the distinction is failures is what happens on the technical level, for example, or related to that faults, which is a bit different. Different hardware components may fail, and then the hazards correspond to what impact this has to, for example, the user of the system. And this is sort of the second step, and I'm here concentrating on the technical level, and where you would probably more focus more on failures, if that answers the question.
But for instance, in a car, if the radio fails, it are not hit in person.
Yes, okay,
the
then... Yes.
It can be a hazard.
Yeah, and this is why I said in the beginning that here I'm now just focusing on safety critical systems by definition in a way. So if the radio fails, then this is not interesting to us here for the moment. Of course, you could model it also with UML, but here I'm not just concentrating on things and on failures that are really safety critical. But okay, yeah, if you would not do this restriction, then you would talk about hazards. Yeah, that's true. But okay. But I think in this situation, this should be clear what I mean. Then. Okay. Now failures. So again, you can try to define them. So this may be an answer also why I talk about failures here. So you could try to come up with a general definition what on the technical level a failure would be, and there you just have to refer to the fact that something fails, which may or may not be safety critical, but on the point is that on the technical level you may not actually see whether it is safety critical, because if you have just a specification of an object, then you may only be able to guess from the name of the object whether this represents a brake by wire system or a radio. And this is something which initially, I mean, it should run really be, these two aspects should really be, you should really be able to modularize that. So here now I'm just looking at failures, which may or may not be safety critical, but otherwise it would be a bit difficult to start with technically defining what a hazard is, because then you have to sort of also include the fact that it's safety critical. And as I said already, these definitions here, I would like to be able to make mathematically precise. And this I can do with this kind of definition. But if I then have to say, would have to say that somehow they should be self-critical, then this is sort of another layer which I would have to bring in already here. But this layer I would rather defer to some later stage of the analysis. So this is also maybe a possible answer to the question. And anyway, so what is the failure now? Here I'm now again concentrating on a specific kind of failure, namely failure in communication between different components in the system. And if you want to communicate data, then different kind of things may go wrong. The data may be delayed, or it may get lost completely, or it may be corrupted. Also a simplifying assumption, which I will make on the next couple of slides to be able to present the things in a relatively simple way, is that these failures actually occur randomly. And this is an assumption you can often make in hardware, where you have components which by design are correct, but which for physical reasons every once in a while may fail. And this is of course different in software, because there the situation is either the software is correct, and then it's always correct, given the, well, at least for a given system, or it's incorrect, and then it's always incorrect, and you may just be lucky to come across the bug or to just execute a different part of the software. And in hardware it's different, you know, as I said, you may have a component which may or may not fail, although it's really, from the design is really identical to another component who may or, which may or may not fail. This allows you to include probabilistic analysis in this context. Yeah, and for the more general situation, it would be a bit more difficult, because you may have to take into consideration things such as the execution history of the system, even with respect to the critical requirements which you have. So, in the literature, you can the fault tolerance literature, you can find different kinds of failure semantics. So, with respect to these failures, you can establish different kinds of behaviors of these failures. And one possibility would be the so-called crash performance failure semantics, meaning that the component may crash or may exceed its time limit, but is partially correct. So it never delivers a wrong result, but it may not deliver any result, or it may deliver it too late, which in practice comes down to a similar result. Too late is pretty much the same as never in practice. And then the second kind of failure semantics is the value failure semantics. This means that a component may actually also deliver incorrect values, and may not only be too late or crash. So these are just two examples for different failure semantics. There are also others, but just these are just used for explaining the ideas. And then, as I said, the focus here is now on fault tolerance within technical systems. And the technique used there is then you realize that, for example, the underlying hardware will fail to some degree, and you may have safety critical requirements on the overall system which are higher than or more stringent than what the hardware actually would give you. And this is a conflict, of course, and there are, of course, standard techniques how to deal with that, using, for example, redundancy, meaning that, for instance, instead of just using one copy of a hardware component, you used a couple of replicated copies, and then you used some kind of voting mechanism to extract from the different results of the different components that may be executed in parallel to extract one final result. So you may have three components and a majority vote. Whatever the two of them say will be taken as the final result. And the goal is then, okay, now coming back to hazards. So this is sort of the link to hazards is here more on the meta level as opposed to the technical level. The goal is then not to have any hazards in presence of single point failures, where so this is supposed to mean that of course if all your replicated copies may fail at a given point in time, then you cannot hope that you can extract a useful result by some voting mechanism. So then your system may actually fail. But the assumption is that it's unlikely enough that several components may fail at the same point in time. So we only consider single point failures. And yeah, as I said already, I will now just focus on state-critical systems. So I don't have to now worry about whether something is a reliability requirement as opposed to safety or not. So for us now, we just focus on technical systems, which may or may not be have to satisfy reliability constraints. And yeah, then just as an example, application domain, what I just said about typical systems applies in particular about or applies to embedded software. And this is increasingly used also in safety critical systems because of the flexibility of using software as opposed to just use hard-coded or programs hard-coded into hardware. And this is done increasingly in all of the important application domains such as automotive, avionics, aeronautics, robotics, and so on. And this is in particular the application domains, or some of them, on which this this work was based. So, for example, we have done some cooperation with BMW in the automotive sector on safety-critical systems, and in the avionics system application domain. With there's been some work at our group with EADS on a model of an airplane. Yeah, so these are the two of the examples. And yeah, as I said already, the intention with this approach is to not just formulate these different aspects informally, but to also have some kind of precise definitions of these things which I mentioned so far, as far as they concern the UML diagrams. And so here I will now try to shortly sketch how this is supposed to look like. Although actually I just noticed that we have 3 o'clock. And so, because this takes a bit longer to explain this in detail, I think I will defer this until after the break. So we now have a coffee break until 3:30, I think, and we'll then just meet here again.
So we have to recover for the remaining 8 slides.
yes. Oh yeah, we have to speed up a bit, but...
well, no, we do.
Well, maybe me too. Well, I guess we are on the same boat in a way. So I can easily speed up, but then we have to make sure that you still follow, you know. But anyway, yeah. Fine with me, yeah. If you are happy with that, 15 minutes, yeah, okay.
If it's okay for you.
Yeah.
Let's see how the hotel serves us.
Okay. So any questions so far about the things which I just said?
Well, I think we can meet around one table anyways.
Yes, okay. So we will try to start in 15 minutes then. Okay.